America's always had big knockdown, drag out fights, but I always remind people that what you may have heard anybody say about anybody else in a campaign these days pales in comparison to what Jefferson and Hamilton said about each other.
Yeah.
Usually using a pseudonym.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It is the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway, along with Cameron Mills.
Hey, buddy.
Dude, what's going on?
Nothing.
We have a very special guest today.
I would say so.
So, we don't like to get into politics, as in partisan politics. But
right.
We have talked to some political people. I mean, we know Congressman Massey has an outhouse.
Right.
Adam Edlin thinks that the world can be run on solar.
Right.
So why not every now and then talk to a politician?
We talk to a lot of politicians.
Yeah, I think it's great. And
now we're talking to the politician.
Well, can you remember the last time that you, like this, I'm saying this rhetorically to Americans. When's the last time you sat down and listened to someone who you may or may not have agreed with politically and just wanted to know who they were as a person?
Yes.
That's kind of a pathway to the better America we want, isn't
nobody
it?
Nobody does that.
Right.
No, everyone listens to who they side with
it.
Or who they think. Well, we're absolutely.
So, we've got Senator Mitch McConnell in the house. How are you, sir?
I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, good to see you.
This should be fun.
I think so.
Hopefully it'll be different than most of the interviews you do.
That'll be a relief.
There we go. That's what we're hoping for. Absolutely.
Well, it's meant to just kind of dig into who you are as a leader. Because one of the things that we're most interested in here in the Disruption Zone is people that are leading, people that are innovating, people that are doing things. And some might say in politics, maybe there isn't as much innovation as there used to be. But I bet you would disagree that you do probably have to innovate a bit.
Yeah, I mean, conditions are always changing. Public opinion is always changing. And we're not, nor should we be, insulated from the people we represent. So, yeah, we're affected by public attitudes about issues and priorities. We try to make an argument for our particular point of view, but you have to sell it.
Right.
Because if you don't sell it, you don't win elections. And I always remind people that winners make policy and losers go do something else.
Elections have consequences.
Yeah, it's not terribly complicated.
I had a conversation a few years ago with Hal Rogers, who's been in office about as long as you have.
Longer.
Yeah. And
Believe it or not.
we were on our way up to Washington, and I was going up to call on him about home health. And we were talking about the difference between being a congressman when he first got into office and now. And he said one of the differences is a long time ago, you all would fly up together on the same airplanes, which I guess still happens a lot now. But then you'd stay in the same apartments with people that were on sometimes the other side of the aisle as you. And you would develop these relationships that would basically be friendships. And he said that doesn't happen as much anymore. And so in his mind, it became harder sometimes to work together because there was this huge dividing line right down that aisle. And so it was this side or this side, and there wasn't any reaching across to a friend who said, you know what, because we're friends, because we know each other, because we roomed together practically back then, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust you've got what's best in mind for the country. Is that true? Do you see it the same way?
That proves it. He's been there longer than I have. Because during the time I've been there, everybody I know in the Senate basically goes home on the weekends.
Okay.
Some of them go all the way to Idaho, Wyoming, the West Coast. So I don't think we're around when there is off time.
Off time.
Having said that, I don't think there is an inability, even though I know it's the storyline these days, I don't think there's an inability to do things on a bipartisan basis.
Okay.
And I don't know about the House, but in the Senate, I don't know anybody who hates anybody else. You know, we haven't had any incidents on the floor like in the 1850s when a congressman came over and almost beat to death a senator with a cane.
People don't know that happened.
No.
That really happened.
Well, it wasn't on TV, so how would we know what happened?
Yeah.
You got to read to get stuff like that.
But the perception you get if you watch cable TV or tune into your favorite website is that we're all at each other's throats on a daily basis. It's simply not true. We have had some very big arguments over big issues, taxes, judges. But the same week we were having a shootout over the Kavanaugh confirmation.
Right.
We passed an opioid bill on a bipartisan basis.
Thank you for that, by the
99-1.
Yep.
We did a five-year airport infrastructure bill, which hadn't been done in 20 years. Mm. Nobody was, you know, at each other's throats to the point where we couldn't function. So I think I don't think there's anything broken about the Senate. America's always had big knockdown, drag-out fights, but I always remind people that what you may have heard anybody say about anybody else in a campaign these days pales in comparison to what Jefferson and Hamilton said about each other.
Yeah,
usually using a pseudonym.
Yeah,
and what's different is the means of communication invite dramatically greater numbers of people into the political debate.
Yeah.
And the personalities of people who are commenting have an impact on it, too. Donald Trump is an interesting character. And
to put it lightly?
Yeah.
What a wonderful way of saying
yeah, it. Yeah, he is. And yeah. He has been for years, and now he's got the biggest platform in the world, and everybody's tuning in to what he has to say, and he says it multiple times every day. And so people, I think, are tuned in more to politics now than they have been in recent years.
I think social media has a lot to do with that. And I think one of the things that happens is, and Leland and I have talked about this before, if you were to solely base your thoughts on what's going on politically in this country, racially in this country, on Twitter, Facebook, you would think that the perception would be that we hate each other. Yeah. That if you're on the other side of the aisle from where I am politically, I have to hate you. There can be no friendship. There can be no common ground. But then you get out in the world, you get out in the streets of Louisville, the streets of Lexington, and all of a sudden, no, it's not like that at all. There are people being kind to each other. There are people who know, just because 50% of the time, you know, chances are they're not going to line up with me politically, but yet they're being kind to me. I'm being kind to them. It just doesn't – I grew up in a society where you didn't talk religion. You didn't talk politics. And there's one other thing you didn't talk when you were in someone's house. And nowadays it's being pushed constantly on social media. Mm-hmm. No, you do have to talk about that stuff.
Well, it could be a division between the followers and the actual politician. Mm. The followers may be getting madder at each other than we get mad at each other. I mean, the Senate is still a collegial place, and we've got everybody from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren over to, you know, Ted Cruz. And there's a broad divide of diverse views all over the place, but I don't see any of it affecting how we treat each other in doing our work.
On or off the floor.
Yeah, on or off the floor.
So how do we fix that, I guess, with us out here? I mean, is that the media's responsibility?
No, I'm not blaming anybody in particular. I just think everybody ought to relax. The country's going to be fine. Right. I mean, you know, we get it in these periods. One of my favorite books was out in the last year, John Meacham, called The Soul of America. And what he does is he kind of takes us through America's low points over the years and demonstrates that none of them are fatal. This big, wonderful country we are so fortunate to live in has a remarkable ability to cure itself. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty hard to break America. But if you're a young person and you haven't lived very long, you think, oh, this just must be the worst time ever. Yeah. I've lived long enough to remember the civil rights battles in the 60s. I mean, this is nowhere near the worst time ever.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. So what has in your tenure, both as a human being, just being alive, and as a senator, what has been the lowest point, not necessarily of your career, but of this country, that you would say?
For the country?
Yeah.
I think the civil rights struggle was a big deal. And nobody would have predicted in the 60s that we'd have an African-American president of the United States elected in 2008. Nobody would have predicted that. I mean, that is a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
We went all the way from segregation in a large portion of our country. And, you know, we've got two competitive governor's races in Georgia and Florida, as we're taping today. With African-American candidates, I think the country has come one heck of a long way in a whole lot of different ways.
Let's talk about you and your growing up years and formative. I mean, you're the longest serving U.S. Senator for Kentucky, 1984 was when you were elected. How did all this start? I mean, when you were, what forged, what made you leader McConnell?
Well, I sort of developed an interest in politics early. I ran for president, student council in high school.
Did you win?
I did. I went to Manual High School here in Louisville. I won.
What was your platform? Free lunches.
I'll
tell you how I won. I was running against a kid who was a better student than I was, and who was considered the favorite. So I'm thinking to myself,
the underdog.
I was thinking to myself, how do I win this race? Who are the best known kids in school? Well, they're the athletes and the cheerleaders.
There we go.
So what I did, I got them to endorse me, and we made up pamphlets. We made up pamphlets, and they said, "Join us and vote for Mitch McConnell for president." You know, so and so, all state football.
That's awesome.
So and so, cheerleader. It worked.
That's awesome.
We put those pamphlets in the lockers.
Oh.
At the time, the school went all the way from the 7th grade through the 12th grade.
Yeah.
But only the juniors and seniors-to-be could run. But none of the junior high-age people knew any of us. But they knew the athletes and the cheerleaders.
That's right.
So I put those pamphlets in every one of their lockers.
That's awesome.
Won it.
That's awesome.
So. Now, how does that compare to running for leader today? Any similarities
well,
there?
Running for leader today is like – if you're looking at a European parliamentary system, it's like being the prime minister.
Right.
You're not elected by everybody in the country. You're elected by the people who
are Senate.
Elected. Yeah. And I'm proud of the fact I've been elected 6 times without opposition, and I have a constituency at the moment of 51. And it's an interesting group with a lot of different points of view. And you know, in order to make some progress, you're always searching for some kind of consensus.
Yeah.
And some people are more willing to play team ball than others. Are you familiar with the 80-20 rule? The 80-20 rule.
I feel like I should be.
Yeah.
You'll remember it when I tell you. The 80-20 rule, for example, applies to men's ties. What it means is you wear 20% of your ties 80% of the time.
Okay.
Conversely, 80% of your ties, you only wear 20% of the time.
Okay.
The nice ones.
Of course, now nobody wears ties at all. For women, jewelry.
Yeah.
If you apply the 80-20 rule to the Senate Republican Conference, I spend 80% of my time with 20% of my members.
Okay.
They're the malcontents and contrarians.
Okay.
You know, who are hard to get behind one particular plan. But you don't want any of the 80 to start envying all the attention the 20 are getting and making even more people go over to that side.
Sounds like babysitting in some sense.
Kind of does.
Yeah. Listen, I have to become what I try to do is become an expert on every one of my members.
Yeah.
What their needs are, what their concerns are. They end up coming to me with personal problems.
Mm.
And so I'm kind of a counselor.
Without trying to make any of your 80 or your 20 any more jealous than they might already be of your time, attention, who do you look at in the Senate as a friend, somebody that you can go to and say, you know what, I need to talk about something?
Yeah, it would probably be Lamar Alexander, who's a senator from Tennessee. We're roughly contemporaries. We were in Washington at the same time during the Nixon administration. And he went back home, ultimately became governor, and actually was president of the University of Tennessee for a while, and then he's had fabulous resumes. He was Secretary of Education during Bush 41 and then got elected to the Senate.
Mm. I've spent a little time talking to some of your staff, and I've noticed this myself, whether you're on the floor or whether – I think the first time you and I met, you were Senate Minority Leader. And we were meeting in your Capitol office, which I thought was one of the coolest moments of my life, getting to meet in I guess, Abraham Lincoln's office, the Lincoln office, I think is what it's called, or something like that, when you were a minority leader.
Yeah.
And you just kind of, you know, we were there waiting because we're not going to be late for a meeting with you, right? And you just kind of strolled in, hand in pocket, and I just thought, there goes one of the coolest individuals. The Fonz just walked by is essentially what I'm saying. And in talking to some of your staff, they just say, you're just always laid back. You never seem too riled. You kind of let your staff do their job, make the assignments, do their job. You're not, you know, you're not what's the word? I want to say not hands-on, but not
micromanaging.
Thank you. So, does that is that true? Is that how you see yourself? And how does that help you in being leader, in being senator, in being politician?
Well, I think it's important to be a good listener, because the people around you, whether it's colleagues that I who elect me leader, or whether it's my own staff, are smart people. And if you're talking all the time, you're not learning much. Also, I'm a little bit like the duck out on the pond. Everything looks a lot smoother than it is underneath. I'm going pedaling pretty fast to avoid sinking. And if I have one quality I think probably has served me well, it's I'm able to kind of stay calm. There are just a lot of things in the world that I live in happening all the time. Many of them you can't control and coming at you. And
like people at restaurants occasionally.
Occasionally people at restaurants. And then things that are not, you know, quite so obvious. And keeping a cool hand. And I've been well served by an awful lot of very smart young people I've been fortunate enough to have work for me, who've made me look a lot better than I am on a daily basis.
Where did you get that calmness from? Did you get it from a parent?
It's hard to know. It's hard to know. I think I probably learned a really significant lesson very early. I was stricken with polio when I was 2 years old.
You bring that up.
This was before the vaccine. And my dad was overseas fighting in World War II. My mother went to live with her sister and took me with her to a little town in Alabama. And the way polio hit people, it was like the flu. And then when the flu went away, you had a problem. And it could be really severe. You could die. You could have a whole lot of paralysis. FDR was paralyzed from the waist down. It affected my left quadricep. And the little country doctor said, I think he's got a problem, but it looks like it may be polio. The good news is we're 60 miles from Warm Springs over in Georgia, which Roosevelt set up as a polio treatment center. He had a lot of money. He used to like to go there. It would literally Warm Springs. And whatever experts there were on physical therapy at that time were there. Mm. And we were lucky, 60 miles away. My mother took me over there. They taught her a physical therapy regimen, 2 years old.
Yeah.
And here's what they told her. Don't let him walk. Because if he tries to walk too soon, we're afraid he'll end up in a brace. Mm. So she literally watched me 24 hours a day for 2 years until I was 4 years old.
And wouldn't.
Administering that physical therapy. And my first memory in life, age four, was when the nurses told my mother they thought I was going to be okay and I could have a normal childhood. Mm. The reason I tell you that story is it was an early lesson in hard work and perseverance give you a good chance to get where you're headed. Mm. And so I sort of tried that all along the way. My memoir is called The Long Game, because mm-hmm. I've been willing to, you know, spend a lot of time on things. When I have run for office, none of them have been an afterthought. I've always spent multiple years on it. I've just felt like if you work harder, lay out a good plan, and give it everything you got, your chances of success go up dramatically. And I've been very fortunate. I'm in a business where it's pretty easy to get knocked off. You know, you take a lot of slings and arrows. But I think early preparation and hard work have made a difference. I had a friend of mine who said the harder he worked, the luckier he got.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Leland and I were talking earlier about a show that we're going to do just together at some point, talking about the value of failure. I mean, you look at your career, how long it is, the success you've had. Is there an area of your political life, or maybe before that, that you're like, you know what, this is an area that not only did I fail at, whatever it is, but it's shaped the way I've Absolutely. Approached something else?
Well, the toughest 10 years of my life were the first 10 years after law school. I had 7 different jobs in 10 years. I mean, if you looked at my resume, you'd say, that's a guy who's not going anywhere.
Because there were so many lines on it.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, just kind of.
There's that duck again, just treading water.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I was having a hard time finding my way forward. Mm. And the notion that success comes easily. It does to some people, but not most people.
Yeah.
Most people, it doesn't come easily to.
And the ones that it doesn't come easier to seem to be able to handle it better than those that come.
Well, I always tell, I spend a lot of time with students. I have a program at U of L called the McConnell Center, which is an undergraduate scholarship program.
It'd be nice if you
program.
Had that at UK too, by the way, but whatever.
Well, thanks a lot, Cameron.
I'm just saying.
I full well remember the day you nailed U of L in Freedom Hall. I don't think you missed a shot the whole game.
Once or twice.
I forgot what I was going to say.
You're talking about the McConnell Center at U of L.
Oh, I tell these kids the only way to fail in America is to give up.
Yep.
Because you are going to have setbacks, but, you know, it's almost never fatal unless you just give up. And if I ever had an inclination to give up, it would have been those 10 years. I was just kind of going in different directions, trying to figure out. I wanted to run for office, but trying to figure out how to get from where I was to where I wanted to get.
Yeah. Because it's not a leap anyone makes. It's from law school graduate to Senate Majority Leader. And that's just, you know, there's a bunch of steps between there. And
well,
there.
The good news is that I've only had two jobs since. I got elected Jefferson County Judge, a job that no longer exists, and then I went to the Senate. So my resume got better, but it was a tough 10 years.
Go ahead, Lee.
Well, I was just going to say, you're married to a woman who has been a cabinet secretary twice now.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like? I mean, you're like the most powerful senator, but then again, talk about a power couple.
Yeah. But she's no slouch.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, twice she's been in a cabinet for two different presidents.
She's got a great resume. I think she's got something like 40 honorary degrees. I'm impressed every day. Well, look, we have busy lives, but we also are both in public service. So in a sense, we're in the same activity. And I try to help her, and she tries to help me. And I think we've had a really good team. And both of us feel fortunate to have been able to.
How long have y'all been married now?
25 years.
I mean, just think about that. That's basically, it's a Hollywood couple. And Hollywood couples
don't last
25 years.
Well, my follow-on question to that is, like, you know, if you meet your soulmate, they make you better. You know, I'm fortunate to have a woman who my wife makes me better as a person.
Yeah.
How does Elaine make you better?
Oh, in all kinds of ways. All kinds of ways. You know what we make for dinner?
What?
Reservations. I didn't marry her for a cooking.
This is on tape, by the way.
She'll hear it. I'm sure she's heard it before, though. You mentioned Lamar Alexander earlier as one of your friends. Who do you look up to as far as a role model? And maybe this is someone that was in leadership when you were coming up as a kid, when you were running for president at Emanuel. Who was someone that you thought, you know what, that's who I want to be like.
Well, my role model when I was a young person in my 20s was the only Republican who was successful in that era, John Sherman Cooper, who was I was an intern in his office one summer. It was the summer of 1964. It was the year that the civil rights filibuster was broken. He was helping to break the filibuster. I went back the next summer to visit him and to visit some of my friends, and he grabbed me by the arm and took me over to the rotunda of the Capitol, and I was quietly in the back of the room, got to watch LBJ sign the Voting Rights Bill of 1965.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
So he was, you know, I looked up to him and I said, gee, I'd like to be like him when I grow up. Mm. I mean, we all, I think, have had somebody like that. For me, it was John Sherman Cooper.
You mentioned that moment with LBJ signing the voter rights. What other moments have you had? Because I remember just the first time I went, and this again goes back to home health for me, because it was the first time I went to D.C. to work, to lobby, to visit my representatives and say, hey, have you considered this when it comes to, you know, the home health and the Medicare cuts? And I remember that whole week I felt more pride because I wasn't going to D.C. to see the sights. I was there to call on my representatives, which was my right and my opportunity. And I felt like I was part of the system in a good way.
You were.
And I love that feeling. But you're there all the time, part of the system, making things work. What do you look at? What memories do you have to say, this was, of all the moments you've had, was the moment, like, man, I can't believe I'm literally watching this happen. And I'll give you an example, even though I know for It's the Other Side Aisle. You brought up having an African-American president. That's not where I line up politically, but I wept when he was inaugurated because I thought, this is where my country is, and I'm proud of where my country is.
It was an important breakthrough.
Absolutely.
It was an important breakthrough for America.
Absolutely it was.
Yeah. Well, I've had a lot of big moments. I think the proudest moments recently were the two Supreme Court justices that both of which I played a significant role in.
Absolutely.
The confirmation of Justice Gorsuch in 2017 and the very confirmation of Justice Kavanaugh in October of 2018.
Is that your legacy?
I think if you're thinking about impact, what would have the longest impact, it would be lifetime appointments to the courts.
Yeah.
And so of the things that I've been involved in over the years, I love the tax reform bill, for example. We never leave the tax code alone.
Yeah.
In a few years, if the political winds shift, the other side will go back at the tax code and do it a different way.
Yeah.
Not much you can do about a lifetime appointment to the courts. And I felt like not only did I play a role in the Gorsuch vacancy being there by making the decision not to fill it when it became vacant with Scalia's passing in 2016, then shepherding through that nomination and the next one will clearly be the most consequential impact I've had for the longest period of time. A lot of other big things we've been involved in, but if you're talking about something that'll last a while.
Yeah.
And we've done 29 circuit court judges, mm-hmm.
which no one really thinks about on the national scale, but they're important.
Most complex litigation doesn't get to the Supreme Court.
Right.
It stops at the circuit courts. The 29 that we've done so far as we're having this interview today is a record for this quick in any administration in history. So I think putting what we call strict constructionists, that is people who believe the job of judge is to follow the law.
Right.
Justice Scalia used to say you're not a very good judge if you're not occasionally uncomfortable with the outcome you reach because it's not your personal opinion.
Right.
It's
what the Constitution.
Yeah. And he used to say if you want to make policy, why don't you run for office? Mm. That's not our job. I would say that's the most consequential thing that I've been involved in my career.
When you're not working, which I don't know how often time you get time to yourself or with you and your wife, and you're not out at a restaurant or reservation, what do you do? Do you read? Is there a television show you like to watch? I mean, how does Mitch McConnell relax, or does he ever?
Yeah, I read a lot of American history, not surprising. Mm. I like it, and it's also, in a sense, I guess, work-related.
Sure.
Learn lessons. Right now I'm reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, which is kind of a waltz through American history, somewhat similar to Meacham, presidents who've had unique challenges and how they dealt with it. And I like sports a lot.
Baseball fan, right?
Yeah, I like college football. I like college basketball, and I follow the Washington Nationals because they're on every night when I get home. I can turn on and watch the last part of the game.
Yeah.
So, I like sports a lot.
One of the things, like, whether you're in the corporate world, whether you're in the, business world, whether you're in the political world, whatever you're doing, it requires us to work with people we disagree with. You mentioned President Obama becoming president. Landmark moment for United States, but also for you, a guy who was opposed to your ideology and vice versa. But you guys had a good relationship, my understanding is.
Well, I was, of course, deeply troubled by his election from a philosophical point
sure.
of view.
How do you work across
with
somebody
you disagree
with?
Well, we actually had a respectful relationship, and I negotiated with his vice president, Joe Biden, three deals that I thought were enough right of center to warrant my involvement. A two-year extension of the Bush tax cuts, what we call the Budget Control Act, which actually reduced spending for 2 years in a row for the first time since right after the Korean War with Barack Obama in the White House. I was pretty proud of that. And then we did another tax extension called the Fiscal Cliff Deal. So when you have divided government, there are certain things you simply have to do. And you the government has to function no matter who gets elected. And I felt like the deals that I did with Biden and Obama were consistent enough with Republican principles to warrant cooperation. He got elected. He was the president of the United States.
Yep. Twice.
There are a lot of people now. I mean, there are a lot of people now who don't want to do anything with President Trump as if he somehow didn't win.
Right.
He did win.
Yeah.
And so I think we have a responsibility, regardless of whether I'm personally like most of what he's doing. But even if we don't, rather than just mindless resistance, I think we have some obligation to try to make the country work.
So what would be your advice then to somebody who is in a situation where they're having to work with people that they disagree with on a regular basis? What do you suggest they look
even
for?
Even take it out of the political realm. I mean, look, it's someone at work
business world
that you don't like, but you've got to work with.
Yeah, I think you have to learn to get along with people.
You got a good joke to leave us with? You got a good joke to leave us with? Your favorite joke? Put you on the spot. Stand-up comedy night.
I wish I
open
knew
mic.
I've already given you a few. I wish I knew.
I know. So I got all excited. So it was good having you in.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
I enjoyed
in.
It.
We really appreciate
good luck,
it.
Good luck with your program.
Thank
and,
you.
We're excited.
We'll get together again sometime.
Awesome. Love fantastic.
Thank
Senator
you,
Mitch McConnell. I am Leland Conway. That
I'm
is Cameron Mills. The Disruption Zone.